Hello, I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And as we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the biz page. And under the heading of Wolfpack Proud, we find the article, Restaurant Jumps In on Endorsements. A glimpse of what's ahead on the college sports scene when it comes to athletes endorsing products can be seen with a well-known Raleigh restaurant with long ties to NC State University. Dick DeAngelis, a former Wolfpack football player, opened Amedeo's in 1963, and the restaurant on Western Boulevard with the tasty lasagna remains a haven for Pack fans. And when the NCAA began to allow athletes to endorse products, Amedeo's co-owners, David Harris and Dave Parker, jumped in and reached deals with a number of athletes, including baseball pitcher Sam Highfield. Amedeo's and nearby Sammy's Tap and Grill have complementary ownership groups and are working with a group of seven athletes on endorsement. Parker says the athletes get gift cards for food in exchange for mentions on their social media feeds. Their parents can use the gift cards when in town as well. Running back Zonovan Knight, for example, has more than 2,800 Twitter followers and more than 7,300 on Instagram. Amedeo's also plans to host Dine with the Team events, where fans can pay a cover charge, which goes to the players, and mingle with the athletes. Also on the biz page, under the heading of Chapel Hill, parking spots disappear. Years ago, the clever University of Virginia marching band performed at halftime in Keenan Stadium, and the band announced it would form something rarely seen in Chapel Hill and promptly set up as an empty parking space. Now, if you're looking for parking in Chapel Hill now, be forewarned that a major renovation on Rosemary Street is underway. So a big parking deck there is being demolished as the town revamps the area to make way for a six-story Grub Properties project. And under the heading of Grocer Plans comes the article, Aldi Targets a New Part of the Triangle. Chapel Hill residents will soon have another grocery store option. German grocery retailer Aldi is pursuing approvals for a new store location in East Gate Crossing Shopping Center, located at the intersection of East Franklin Street and Fordham Boulevard. When it comes to choosing new store locations, we carefully consider several factors. Bottom line, we look for convenient locations for our customers that can support a high traffic volume daily, says Krista Searley, Salisbury Division Vice President at Aldi. The closest Aldi to Chapel Hill now is in Durham off NC Highway 751. The company announced in February plans to add about 100 new stores in 2021 to continue its coast-to-coast expansion and goal to become the third largest grocery retailer by store count by the end of 2022. Under the heading of Testimony, the article, A.G. Stein Pushes for Vaping Restrictions. The latest push by North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein against the vaping industry came August the 3rd. When he testified before a U.S. Senate subcommittee on the dangers of vaping ads when it comes to young people. Earlier this year, North Carolina became the first state to obtain a consent judgment against Juul over its marketing to kids. That settlement requires Juul to pay North Carolina $40 million. And under the heading of Tobacco to Food comes the article, Development Gains Steam in Henderson. Baltimore-based Aquist Group is turning an old tobacco warehouse in Henderson into a food hall and public marketplace, and tenants are starting to come on board. A handful of local establishments, Kerr Area Rural Medical Alliance, R&J's Fish Wings and Things, Happy Times Food Truck, Dreamville Italian Ice, and Uncle Lou's Restaurant and Pub, which will open a new pizza concept, have signed letters of intent to occupy space at the warehouse. Aquest is investing elsewhere in the area, too, as it plans to bring affordable housing and a new office to the Vance County City. To say we're invested in Henderson would be the understatement of the century, says Alexander Green, Acquest Group Vice President and Director of Operations. And finally on the biz page, under the heading of Jobs to Fill, comes the article, Work by the Sea, Plea Not Enough. Thanks to a boost from a local real estate firm, an NC State University professor whose expertise is sustainable tourism has spent 2 months on the Outer Banks looking at ways the area can solve long-term problems such as infrastructure, housing, and finding workers. NC State's College of Natural Resources has partnered with Twitty and Company, which manages more than 1,100 vacation homes on the Outer Banks, to help fund research by Assistant Professor Whitney Nolenberg. Chuck Twitty, the president of the firm, and Nolenberg began discussing ideas a few years back, and Twitty offered to help fund research to address the problem. She's lived in the village of Kerala for 2 months, talking to local residents and business owners about their challenges. For example, she says one rental agency that needed 200 workers to turn around rental properties couldn't find enough locally, so it pulled in workers from as far away as Petersburg, Virginia. Nolenberg says many restaurants had help wanted signs as they struggled to fill shifts. What you saw were incredible numbers of restaurants that were closed 2 days of the week in peak season, she says. You would never see that in the past. Those signs, Nolenberg says, were an indicator that there are issues here long term that need to be considered. Thanks to funding from Twitty and Company, Nolenberg will stay involved, making suggestions and offering options. Access to housing, support for workers such as child care and job training, are all ways to lure workers. And Nolenberg hopes her work will spark more conversations between businesses and local officials. Now we'll turn the page and we find a few news articles here. Under the heading of retail comes the article, Advance Auto Parts and Wake Tech College Partner on Recruitment Program. Advance Auto Parts has teamed up with Wake Technical Community College to address the auto industry's technician shortage, while also tackling issues of diversity. The retailer wants to attract a more diverse group of students to the school's automotive programs. The Fortune 500 company will contribute $200,000 to the Technician Initiative and to support Wake Tech's Hendrick Center for Automotive Excellence, which is set to open this fall. The company will also contribute $50,000 to outfit the center's two tool rooms. The plan comes as the U.S. experiences a technician shortage due to a lack of qualified people entering the field, says Advance Auto Parts CEO Tom Greco. If the industry continues expanding at its current rate, Greco says there could be a shortage of over 600,000 technicians by 2024. The shortage is the biggest issue for the professional side of Advance Auto Parts' business, which consists of installers at over 100,000 garages nationwide. We want to help them not only solve the problem for their business, which is to get mechanics into their shops to repair vehicles, but to also increase their diverse representation, Greco says. The 42,100,000-square-foot Hendrick Center will enable Wake Tech to more than double the number of students in its Automotive Systems Technology program from 90 to 200 and add a new degree program in collision repair. Also on the news page under the heading Raleigh comes the article, D.C.-based developer unveils new area project. A Washington, D.C.-based developer is planning a large mixed-use project in downtown Raleigh. Dalian Development has filed site plans with the city for 501 Hillsborough, a proposed eight-story development between Hillsborough and West Morgan Streets. The project would include a mix of commercial and residential space totaling 166,166 square feet at the corner of Hillsborough and Southwest Streets near Morgan Street Food Hall. Plans show residential units above office and retail space. The 1.2-acre site covers a whole city block and includes 10 parcels. on Hillsborough Street, 501, 509, 513, and 515. On Southwest Street, 10. And on West Morgan Street, 502, 510, 512, and 514. All but two of the parcels are owned by a Raleigh-based LLC, HBS Properties 3, while the other two are owned by an LLC linked to Dalian Development. Together, the properties have an assessed value of more than $6 million. The site currently has a mix of single-story office and retail space. Site plans show the development would have five stories for residential space with 233 apartments, 202 one-bedroom units and 25 two-bedroom units, and six three-bedroom units. Below that would be a mix of office and retail space. A single building development would also include a parking deck. Raleigh-based Klein Design is the architect on the project, while McAdams is handling engineering and planning. Well, now we'll turn the page, and we find ourselves on the tech and transport page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading Temporary Home comes the article, Apple Preps for Carry Move. As it plans its massive 3,000-job hub in Research Triangle Park, Apple is moving ahead with its temporary office space in Cary. Apple is pulling the trigger on improvements at 301 MetLife Way, a Class A office building at MetLife's sprawling Cary campus, planned to be its temporary home. Permits approved by the town show Apple is already executing on plans for what it calls Phase 1, the first three floors of the building. The tech giant will start with about 90,000 square feet on the first three floors, which permits show will see renovations from the paneling to the HVAC system. Permits filed with Cary show a $5.4 million renovation project for those floors and list Apple as the tenant. The intent for the near future is for the client to fully occupy the building as the sole tenant, Zayed Musmar, project architect for O'Brien Atkins, wrote to town officials July 7th, according to public records. Altogether, the building, known as MetLife Building 3, is more than 200,000 square feet. Sources have said Apple wants to move fast with its local plans, a notion that's reflected in the documents. Triangle Business Journal has been told Apple could hire as many as 1,000 workers within a short time. Altogether, it's pledged at least 3,000 jobs at its eventual RTP site. Apple announced its plans for a new campus in the Triangle in the spring, with plans calling for a $1 billion investment over 10 years and jobs with an average salary of $187,000 starting in 2023. The company could receive as much as $845.8 million in incentives over the next 39 years. And now on the same tech and transport page, a couple of short articles here under the heading of Highways. Infrastructure played key role in North Carolina expansions. A 500-job Amazon project in Johnston County, a 3,000-job Centene Corporation hub in Charlotte, neither would have happened without transportation infrastructure and heavy rallying by state and local officials. That's the takeaway of an economic development panel held last month, part of the North Carolina Chamber's Transportation and Infrastructure Summit. Joe Nolan, senior manager of public policy at Amazon, said that access to major highways is essential every time the company expands, including at the cross-dock facility it's building in Smithfield, where Interstate 95 runs along the edge of town. Cross-dock facilities are where products begin their path inside the Amazon supply chain before ultimately reaching the customer's front door. Our biggest priority is getting the customers the products they want and need as quickly as possible, Nolan says. For Centene, Charlotte will actually improve nearby roadways as part of an incentive to reel in the mega project. Thomas Irwin, the retired senior vice president of regional development and political affairs at Centene, says public transportation availability was also essential, as was the nearby Charlotte Douglas International Airport. And under the heading of Cumberland County, the article, Falling Luggage Leads to Lawsuit. A man who claims falling luggage ruined his military career is suing United Airlines. Karen Dixon says a 2019 trip from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to the U.S. Virgin Islands went awry when, upon arrival, the luggage bin suddenly opened, rendering him unconscious. The federal lawsuit filed in Cumberland County claims the falling luggage caused serious and permanent injuries to Dixon's shoulder, neck, and head. He also claims his military career was terminated due to medical, psychological, and physical reasons. A United Airlines representative declined to comment. And finally, a little bar graph article here entitled UNC and NC State See Cyber Insurance Costs Increase. And what we have here are a bar graph, two bar graphs specifically, for the years 2018, 19, 20, and 21 for NC State and UNC Chapel Hill. The article reads, as headlines about ransomware attacks continue, area universities are seeking to mitigate potential damage, and those steps include cybersecurity insurance. So here are the annual premiums paid by UNC Chapel Hill and NC State University for cyber insurance over the past 4 years. Without getting all into the nitty-gritty for each, we'll start with NC State because that's at the top of the bar graph here. And they started in 2018 with expenses of about $84,000. In 2021, that number was $175,000. For Chapel Hill in 2018, the number was $248,000. And in 2021, they're at $275,000. Lots of money for cybersecurity insurance. Now we turn to the next page of this week's TBJ, and we find it one entitled On Greater Triangle Growth. And the lead article is from Chatham County, and it says the article is entitled Mosaic Makes the First Move. After years of planning, permitting, and construction, Mosaic at Chatham Park's first tenant is open for business. The 44-acre mixed-use development that will serve as the commercial gateway to the larger 7,100-acre Chatham Park development recently saw UNC Health open its 7,500-square-foot space that will offer urgent care and rheumatology services, says Kirk Bradley, manager of Eco Group, which is developing the project. Construction is progressing elsewhere in the development. We've got seven buildings now either complete or under construction, Bradley says. Of the buildings we have complete or under construction, they're about 98% leased. One of those buildings is a 165-unit apartment complex called The Guild, which will be managed by Kane Residential, part of Raleigh-based Kane Realty Corporation, and that will be delivering in quarter one of 2023. 12 condominiums are expected to deliver around the same time. Three units are already under contract, Bradley says. This fall will also see the completion of the development's first entertainment venue, a space featuring a lawn and stage. Mosaic will host events with live entertainment on the weekends of October 1st and 2nd, 8 and 9, and 15 and 16 that coincide with the Triangle Parade of Homes. Work on the development will continue throughout the next few years, and Bradley said he estimated 2024 or possibly 2025 will be the date when everything would be built and leased. Next, we turn the page. We find the retail and restaurants page. Under the heading of closing comes the article, End of an Era for Dealer. A gun distributor in Raleigh has filed to reorganize to Chapter 11 bankruptcy and plans to permanently close after operating for 24 years. Shooting Sports Wholesale, LLC, listed assets between $50,000 and $100,000, with liabilities between $1 million to $10 million, according to the filing. Owner Robert Warren filed for bankruptcy July 27th in the Eastern District of North Carolina. Business began to decline for the family-owned company after Warren's father, Robert Warren II, died in 2018, and the pandemic added to the financial strain, says representing attorney Danny Bradford in Cary. The father-son team started the business in 1997. In 2020, with COVID, their gross receipts decreased about 75%, Bradford says. They need to liquidate to shut it down because they are not able to make the cash flow requirements to keep it open. The company's gross revenue was about $70,000 in the first 7 months of 2021, according to the filing. Last year, the company grossed about $577,000 and about $1 million in 2019. Warren, who has run the company with his wife, laid off their three employees in March. They plan to liquidate the remaining inventory through a private sale, as well as an auction in the coming weeks, Bradford says. They closed officially the day before we filed the case, but they weren't really open for business since the end of March, he says. They appreciate all the years of support that they received from the community, Bradford says. The independent sporting arms dealer leased space at 2400 Atlantic Avenue in Raleigh for $4,900 per month, according to the documents. Shooting Sports Wholesale only sold businesses with an approved federal firearms license, according to its website. Additionally, the company was approved for a $22,400 payroll protection program loan in April 2020 that has since been forgiven. Now we turn the page and we reach the executive voice column for this week's Triangle Business Journal, and this week's executive voice belongs to David Wary. In 2019, Gary Loveman, longtime chairman and CEO of Caesars Entertainment Company, and David Wary founded Well.Inc. and designed an artificially intelligent platform that serves as a personalized health guide with on-demand health experts. The app is intended to help users achieve their best health through reminders and rewards. Now the company is ramping up an expansion effort that will establish its healthcare technology operations center in Chapel Hill, invest $3 million in Orange County, and add 400 jobs. The company picked Chapel Hill over Boston and was approved for an incentives package worth nearly $3.9 million. Well had 17 employees in Chapel Hill at the time of that announcement. Bulking up to 400 jobs would make it one of the largest employers in Orange County. It now sits at about 100 employees. So, as you may know, Executive Voice is a Q&A column, so here's some questions. Tell us about Well. We founded Well because we believed everyone deserves access to a trusted, on-demand health concierge to navigate the healthcare system and act as an always-by-your-side expert to achieve your best health and lower costs. We utilize cutting-edge technology, data and analytics, and behavioral economics to deliver personalized health engagement at scale, which is accessible to all. We have about 100 employees and four office locations, that is, co-headquarters is Chapel Hill and Newton, Massachusetts, and also offices in New York City and Minneapolis. We've raised two rounds of funding totaling $65 million primarily from General Catalyst, BCBSNC, Hellman and Friedman Partners, and John Doerr. So, how did Well get started? Gary Loveman and I co-founded the company in February of 2019. Gary recruited me to Aetna to lead all of Aetna's member-facing capabilities and business units. We both left Aetna following the acquisition of the company by CVS. We saw the significant need for individuals to have increased trusted health support, and that fueled our passion to build Well from the ground up. So what professional experiences have you had that prepared you for this role? My leadership role within Aetna was a central experience that led to our belief in the glaring gap for individuals and the ability to deliver through our own company and initiative. Also, my time as an executive at PPD Learning from CEO David Simmons and in the healthcare investment world both developed expertise that's been important as we grow a company from a blank sheet of paper in a very dynamic industry and time period. In November of 2019, Well announced it would establish its healthcare technology operations center in Chapel Hill, investing $3 million in Orange County and adding 400 jobs. How's that process going? What's the latest? We've had a very close partnership with the town of Chapel Hill, UNC Chapel Hill, Orange County, and Governor Roy Cooper, as we've made Chapel Hill our headquarters and the primary area of growth for our new hires as we expand. We are continuing to add roles and employees to our commitment of 400 jobs in Chapel Hill. What are your goals for Well? Short term, we have some major customer launches with world-class employers that are very exciting. We also have a few underserved community launches dedicated to increasing health access and health equity, which is a major priority for our company and team. We're focused on ensuring we deliver to our members the same levels of service and support as we aggressively scale our membership. Longer term, our goal is to give access to our platform to as many individuals as we can to increase health access, health support, and provide a trusted platform for whole health advancement. I'd like to send tens of millions of individuals on our platform over the coming years. And finally, a couple last questions. What do you do to relax? Running, golf, and cutting my grass. Those three activities allow me to relax and let my mind wander more freely to create unstructured thinking space. Finally, what books are currently on your nightstand? I just finished a book on the Caesar's Restructuring, which is fascinating to learn more about that period during which Carey's was leading Caesar's and dealing with the private equity firms known as the Caesar's Palace Coop. We turn the page and we reach sort of an unusual article because it's written by the editor-in-chief of Triangle Business Journal. And he's introducing a year-long series on showcasing businesses. And it's entitled The Coming of 52 Shades, Area Strengths of Inclusion and Global Influence. So here's Editor Mukherjee's article on this, introducing this column. As I write this column to introduce our year-long series on showcasing businesses, individuals, and topics of interest to forward much-needed diversity, equality, and inclusion issues, it would be remiss of me not to mention President John F. Kennedy's view on America. In the last weeks of his life, he said, "I look forward to an America which commands respect throughout the world, not only for its strength, but for its civilization as well. And I look forward to a world in which we will be safe not only for democracy and diversity, but also for personal distinction." The 52 Shades of Success project is based on Kennedy's challenge for all of us to make sure we allow for and celebrate diversity and distinction. Watching and reading some of the horrific reports late last year from all across the country detailing the violence and hatred toward Asian Americans became personal for me. But the more we look to understand the vitriolic reaction toward a specific class of people, the more it became clear that the nation's focus on diversity, equality, and inclusion could not have come at a better time. That got us to roll up our sleeves and expand on the Promise Solve project we successfully executed in the past years. Our readers know the Promise Solve project focused solely on black-owned businesses. We are thrilled that so many of these businesses we featured came back and told us the project resulted and new business connections for them with new dollars added to the top line. We expect the same results from our 52 Shades project. We've identified a group of advisors representing a kaleidoscope of business groups focused on inclusion, equality, and diversity initiatives. The group will assist us in identifying companies and individuals we should look at and shine a spotlight on. Over the next 12 months, we'll showcase at least one business or an individual every week and talk about their journeys, the opportunities and challenges faced by the businesses in our communities. We will seek answers and challenge our readers and business partners to become a part of the solution in discovering the things that unite us. The economic effect of bringing the world to the Tar Heel State has been nothing less than spectacular. In 2020 alone, foreign direct investment in North Carolina produced more than 2,600 jobs and totaled $1.36 billion in capital investment. Immigrants, who accounted for 11% of the state's labor force in May of 2019, are twice as likely to start their own businesses as native-born people. That entrepreneurial activity generates about $1 billion in annual business revenue in our state. But 52 Shades will go beyond just looking into businesses started by immigrants. We must be aware of others who add to the colorful fabric of our society, specifically our veterans, our disabled, and our LGBTQ communities. We'll write stories about businesses and individuals who truly are making a difference in our communities. For corporate giants such as Apple, Google, and Fujifilm Diosynth that announced their next big $1 billion-plus investments will happen in the Triangle. Also in the next year, we'll explore and search for answers on four specific topics, one a quarter, relating to diversity, equity, and inclusion issues, and sustainability and governance components. Our first deep dive is on local corporations and their diversity initiatives, and whether what they preach is reflected on their management and board of directors. I'm sure some of these numbers you see in the following pages will surprise you. We'll notify our readers on other issues of interest that will be the focus of Twitchy's 52 Shades Project in the coming months. We hope you enjoy the feature. Reach out to me with your comments and questions at sugata@bizjournals.com. And now we turn the page and we find the initial article in the 52 Shades of Success program, and it's entitled Moving Beyond Face Value. Take a look at the directors seated at the boards of Triangle Public Companies. Nearly 75% are white men. In total, 91% of Triangle boards are made up of white leaders. 81.5% are male. The C-suite and executive leadership across these companies is similarly skewed. 91% are white, 75% male. What businesses have learned is that when organizations reflect diversity, they have more sustainable success. According to research from the diversity movement, organizations that embrace diversity and inclusion generate 19 to 35% more revenue than their peers. The message resonating through boardrooms is that more diversity produces more dollars. That's been true for Advance Auto Parts, where the focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion began in earnest when CEO Tom Greco came on board in 2016. Sales grew from $9.5 billion that year to $10.1 billion in 2020. Across that same period, net income increased from $459 million to $493 million. Total stockholders' equity went from $2.9 billion to $3.55 billion. In 2020, comp store sales grew at 2.4%, compared with a 1.4% decline in comp sales in 2016. Since our company began this journey to make diversity part of the fabric of our culture, our performance has improved year over year, says Natalie Rothman, Chief Human Resources Officer, who also joined Advance Auto in 2016. I believe there's a direct correlation between diversity and performance. Bringing in people with different experiences and backgrounds breeds innovation and risk-taking. It makes the company stronger. Across Advance Auto's 68,000 team members, 22.3% are female, 36.1% are people of color. Among executives who report to the CEO, 28.6% are female, and 21.4% are people of color. But diversity is not defined solely by race and gender. To be truly diverse, a broad spectrum of individuals must be represented across the enterprise. Sometimes the word diversity becomes synonymous with the discussion of race, says Donald Thompson, founder and CEO of the Diversity Movement. We work hard to talk about the kaleidoscope of diversity versus one specific element. Katie Rowan, Senior Vice President, General Counsel, and Interim Chief HR Officer at Vontier Corporation, describes it this way. You want the diversity piece to catch as much as possible all backgrounds. That cuts across sexual orientation, sex and gender identity, race and ethnicity, nationality, religion, age and disability status. The more lenses you can have, the better. Vontier, which was spun out of Fortive in October, has the advantage of being able to define its corporate entity with all of those lenses in place from day one. A lot of companies focus first on diversity. We intentionally called our program IDE, that's Inclusion, Diversity, and Equity, because starting with the inclusion part is so critical, Rowan explains. Word choice and order matters. Inclusion takes everybody. If one person on the team is doing things to be exclusionary, then all of your efforts, education, and benefits are for naught. IDE is about bringing the entire organization along and creating an environment where employees can feel like they belong and be themselves in the office. That's true wherever the office is located. In addition to its Raleigh headquarters, Vontier has 5 offices around the United States and more than 150 international locations with more than 8,300 global team members. What is inclusive in China might be different than what inclusion means in Europe or the U.S., so it's important to have a global lens and framework with respect to I&D, and it's important that it's employee-led and employee-influenced as much as possible, Rowan says. Increasingly, companies are creating C-level and executive roles to address diversity and inclusion within their organizations. Trulient Federal Credit Union, based in Winston-Salem, hired Veronica Calderon as Senior Vice President of DEI in January. She's advanced our thought leadership in this area, providing more strategic direction and creating connections that weren't in place before, says Todd Hall, President and CEO of Trulient. Our board and leadership are extremely supportive of the strategy we're building around 4 focus areas: employees, the communities we serve, supplier diversity, and attracting and addressing the needs of our members. Last year, Advance Auto promoted Dina Lamar to Vice President and Chief DEI Officer. She was a great field operator for us, and we felt it important to have an office of diversity instead of just have it as a part of the HR department. Dina reports to our CEO. Her team and my team are intertwined to make sure diversity is part of all the programs we have, Rothman says. From the front lines to the top floor, AAP has integrated diversity into its recruiting and retention processes. We make sure we have diverse slates of candidates and a pipeline of diverse talent, but we also make sure there's diversity in our interview panels, Rothman notes. Diversity has to actually be woven into all the processes that you have. Can't be a separate initiative. Management bias training has to be part of the regular training you do, not a separate thing. That's why diversity and inclusion have worked in Advance, because it's baked into our DNA as a company. Their biggest challenge? Overcoming the misconception that the automotive industry is not diverse. That's been the most interesting thing. How to attract diverse talent to a company where people may have preconceived notions of what we are all about. We put a lot of effort into having diverse interview panels, and when they come to Advance, they see that our leadership is diverse, she says. Rothman measures Advance Auto's DEI success not only in the financial performance of the company, but also in the retention of talent and lower turnover. In 2020, the company promoted 6,000 team members, including elevating 800 employees from hourly to salaried roles. From his vantage point of advising corporate leaders, Thompson offers specific recommendations for successfully recruiting and building a diverse workforce. Where the DEI leader is placed in the organization is significant, he says. Are they 3 levels below the HR leader or reporting directly to the CEO? If this is going to be a transformational event within your coordination, within your organization, they need to report to the CEO or at a level where the CEO has high interaction. The training of the executive leadership team and the support and resources allocated to the DEI initiative will carry considerable weight in determining outcomes. You shouldn't hire a chief diversity officer if you're not willing to fund the role. And it's not just a single role, Thompson says. Most organizations that hire a DEI leader need at least 2 or 3 additional individuals to build a program that has the ability to create systemic change. The team should include people who are external to the organization and will bring new thinking, as well as internal people who know the culture as it exists today. One of the challenges for a DEI officer is that they spend their first 6 months getting to know the organization. His suggestion is for companies to create programming prior to the arrival of a diversity executive that articulates the elements already in existence, outlining the current state of the recruiting process as well as any data or corporate surveys of cultural sentiment. You want to have some foundation set when your DEI head comes in so they can hit the ground running, he notes. Like many corporations, Advance Auto and Vontier have created employee research groups, or ERGs, across a number of cohorts, each open to anyone interested in learning more about how to be inclusive and supportive of colleagues. The key is making sure these ERGs go beyond events and create paths to career progression and inclusion. All of our ERGs serve a purpose. They aren't just about events, Rothman says. It's about learning, building careers at Advance Auto, and some help with us recruiting. At Vontier, the ERGs work to build an inclusive environment that's genuinely welcoming. It's about creating an environment where people are not only supportive of one another, but actually buy into the idea that the more lenses we have, the better, Rowan says. Each Vontier ERG has an executive sponsor and is run by a leadership team, which creates opportunities for team members across disciplines to lead together. Rowan, who grew up in a military family, is the executive sponsor of the Veterans Group. That employee-led, employee autonomy lens is very important when talking about inclusion and diversity, she says, adding that the company intentionally assigned executives to ERGs with an eye toward reinforcing inclusion. I'm openly gay, and I'm not leading the LGBTQ group. I'm honored to lead the Veterans Group, Rowan says. While it's obvious if the people joining you at the table are black or brown or white, other diverse characteristics are not instantly recognizable. I've actually been reflecting on the need for visibility a lot, especially during Pride Month. And for me, being expressly out is important, Rowan says. It's important that all employees, including underrepresented minorities, see themselves represented in senior leadership. That visibility is really important, and although I'm wildly introverted, I feel a responsibility to be open. As awareness escalates around the topic of DEI, the conversation can become diluted with buzzwords. In many companies, the discussion of environmental, social, and governance issues, that's ESG, becomes interchangeable with DEI. One of the reasons DEI programs don't work is because people try to blend social justice with diversity and inclusion programs, Thompson says. Social justice is a driver for why we need to think about DEI, but it's not the same thing. Social justice is about how the company reacted to the murder of George Floyd and how the corporation is supporting community outreach programs. Creating equity in our communities is a good thing. But diversity, equity, and inclusion is the work of the corporation to create more belonging and more productivity at work. Corporations can and should do both. The problem is in confusing the work of the two. The progress a company makes in creating diversity and inclusion internally, and the work it does to support ESG issues globally and among its constituencies, reinforce one another. There's so much noise under the ESG umbrella that it can be hard to know what to talk about, says Rowan. Our ESG program is anchored in supporting a better team. If we focus on our people first, on their safety and well-being, that will drive better innovation, a better planet, better governance, a better society. It's a philosophical approach that underscores our vision statement. I belong here. We believe by focusing on our employees first, it will better benefit other stakeholders, including our customers and investors. Building empathy for its employees is central to the HR initiatives at both Vontier and Advance Auto. Rothman says that empathy is the most important quality a leader can possess. As Gen Z enters the workforce in growing numbers, empathy is a word they use a lot, and empathy is an expectation that guides this generation's decisions for where they work. The other thing that the Gen Z cohort cares about is companies that do good and give back. Our ESG report reflects what Advance Auto is doing, and it resonates with Gen Z. A lot of people look at that report before they interview with us, Rothman says. During the pandemic, Advance conducted manager training to promote total wellness and help its leaders know how to display empathy to teams who were working virtually, as well as those who worked in DCs and stores. For many of the executives who have been leading their companies or boards for decades, all the conversation around empathy, support, and humility may seem like learning a foreign language. Certainly it's a new day, but a much needed day. This is a business imperative at this point. I don't think you can be an effective senior leader or a contemporary leader if you don't have a strong sense of empathy, if you can't model vulnerability as a human being, Ruin says. It's not an option to say, I don't know how to have this discussion, or I don't know how to push this initiative, so I'm going to stay silent. You have to bring in the expertise and resources to help build your program. Dr. Michael Waldrum, CEO of Greenville-based Vidant Health, is working to do just that in the healthcare system Vidant operates across 29 counties, from Wilson to the coast. In order to create a truly inclusive culture where everyone feels a strong sense of belonging, it's imperative to include everyone in discussions, including board members, he says. We've launched a masterclass for board members to help expand their perspectives with the goal of enhancing decision-making in the best interest of all of Vidant's diverse stakeholders. Businesses must be bold in this space and unafraid to address the realities of inequity. Thompson says the biggest hurdle he faces talking with CEOs is their fear of saying the wrong thing, particularly in an overly critical climate. Negative interpretation of good intentions, that's one of the biggest fears, he says. If a word is said wrong or something came out in an unintended way in a public forum, it could affect stock prices. What's holding us all back from digging into this DEI conversation is that a lot of leaders are saying nothing. We have to create space for leaders to fully use their voice in this moment. The CEOs who are most outspoken have full alignment with their boards on where they stand with DEI issues. When a CEI has the support of the power structure they report to, they will be bolder. And as we come close to the end of our TVJ reading for this week, we find a short article here called Foundation of Hope event coming in September. The Foundation of Hope in Raleigh, which looks to support research into mental illness, has two events coming up in September. On September 22nd, the Band of Oz will perform for a night of dinner and dancing at the Igniting Hope event at the Pavilion at the Ingus Barn. Chef Walter Royal will prepare a southern menu for the event, with tickets costing $250. On September 23rd, there's a gala at the Pavilion at the Ingus Barn featuring singer Leanne Rimes called The Evening of Hope. Tickets are $750 each, and Royal will prepare an elegant five-course dinner for up to 300 guests. Sponsorship opportunities are available. Well, we've reached the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and that page usually continues two columns, as it does this week, one of which is the editor's notebook. And in that, the editor-in-chief, Sugata Mukherjee, has written an article entitled A Dangerous Game of Credit Takes Ominous Turn. On August the 2nd, Square, the digital payments platform helmed by Twitter Incorporated founder Jack Dorsey, announced it will spend $29 billion for Australia-based Afterpay, a buy now, pay later, that's called BNPL, company. Yes, you read that right, $29 billion. This will allow Square's product, Cash App, to join forces with Afterpay and create an enhanced financial services product that can be used by individuals and merchants. Square paid that money because its management and board believes that younger consumers are moving away from traditional credit in an effort to get instant access to funds. Just last year, BNPL fintechs generated about $25 billion in transactions, and the sector is growing fast. Of those who participated in a BNPL program last year, 27% were aged 19 to 25, while 48% were 36 to 34, according to Cardify.ai, a firm that tracks consumer spending data. What worries me are the younger group of spenders. Afterpay's tools allow consumers to purchase items instantly on credit and then agree to an installment plan. The company's website touts that the method is popular with younger consumers who want to buy clothes, beauty products, and homewares whenever they want. There are no fees or interest if consumers pay on time. But if a payment is missed, it triggers massive interest and late fee charges on a daily basis. Now remember, this buy now, pay later concept isn't new. People have purchased furniture and other household products on credit from retailers for years. But there's a big difference. The concept was available to adults who may have built up a credit profile for years and have had a sustained revenue source, such as a job. This time around, the popularity of this concept rests on younger people, and there are companies betting billions of dollars on it. You have to be 18 to have an account after passing a soft credit check, which really is unlikely to show much since the account holder could be in college. And who, at 18, 19, or 20, would have solid financial sense when it comes to their decisions? We can't even get student loans paid off. This marketing ploy could ruin the financial lives of millions of people by dangling fancy products and services in front of them and luring them to sign installment loan payments. Why is that different from the housing crash of 2007 and 8? Banks and other financial firms dangled homes to consumers that couldn't afford them, made them sign one-page documents without checking if folks could afford those homes, and built up trillions of useless mortgages, knowing full well that a large portion would go into default. Who paid the price back then? The answer? The world. Retirement money vanished. Savings rates dwindled. Businesses shuttered. Marketing products to younger people has its advantages, but if we don't mitigate the flow of the dollar with some sort of regulatory oversight, we could enter an ominous period of financing. I know fintechs will hate to hear of any regulatory change, just as banks will, but all new products should be heavily reviewed before approval. Square's Dorsey is ecstatic and says he's trying to build a financial system more fair, accessible, and inclusive. Now, that sounds good. But why are these companies marketing these to the younger audience, many of whom have limited fiscal discipline to manage a series of BNPL loans? What will happen when they understand that they can't pay these loans? Non-payments will get reported to credit bureaus, and that would make it difficult to buy homes and cars later on in life. We just made it easier to splurge on our desires regardless of our ability to pay. That simply is not good public policy. Now, off to those boomer jokes. Well, now we come to the guest editorial on the Viewpoint page, and this week's editorial is written by John Hood, a John Locke Foundation board member. His article is entitled, Lay Welcome Mat for New Houses. When demand exceeds supply, prices rise. While the problem of housing affordability has many facets and effects, that inescapable fact explains a lot about why so many North Carolinians struggle to afford the homes they'd like to buy or rent. It's not as if there are many idle home builders in our state. In fact, by one measure, North Carolina is doing better than average. When the Manhattan Institute compared job growth to housing permits in the 20 fastest-growing metropolitan areas, the three North Carolina metros on the list fared very well. Durham-Chapel Hill was number one. Raleigh-Cary, number three, and Charlotte-Concord-Gastonia, number four. Alas, this isn't the whole story. It misses an important stock and flow dynamic. Yes, over the past decade, North Carolina metros have been more accommodating than most of their peers in allowing new home starts to keep up with new residents. But our state began the decade with too many consumers chasing too few housing units. Take a look at the most recent affordability data from the National Association of Home Builders in Wells Fargo. Their study compares the median sales price of homes to the median income in each jurisdiction. For the first quarter of 2021, NAHB Wells Fargo produced affordability scores for 233 metros. North Carolina's highest ranking places for home affordability were Fayetteville, 32, and Winston-Salem at 58. Greensboro High Point at 96, Raleigh-Cary at 102, Durham-Chapel Hill at 113, Charlotte-Concord-Gastonia with 124, and Asheville at 150 face bigger challenges. Our housing markets aren't as locked up as those in California or New York, to be sure. That's one reason why Californians and New Yorkers, among others, continue to move here in significant numbers. But home affordability in North Carolina is still a worrisome problem. Most policymakers agree with that, of course. Where they disagree is how North Carolina state and local governments should go about trying to address it. For decades, my John Locke Foundation colleagues and I have recommended that we loosen housing and zoning regulations to make it easier to provide housing to people of modest means. Yes, that means allowing more units per acre of increasingly pricey land. It means duplexes and triplexes. It means allowing homeowners to rent out spare rooms. It even means allowing more manufactured housing within municipal limits. A serious effort to promote affordability in North Carolina also means reducing how long it takes from planning stage to final construction for home builders to bring new inventory to market. It means streamlining the process for obtaining permits. It means letting producers and consumers meet in the middle, trading off amenities for price, rather than imposing housing codes that reflect the preferences of existing residents over those of newcomers. Such an effort, then, isn't just about the precise wording of laws or the detailed analysis of regulations. It's about public attitude. Do people other than buyers and sellers have a legitimate interest in the amount and type of housing stock erected in the community? To a limited extent, yes, regarding public services such as roads or water and sewer. But when you buy or rent a place to live, you don't purchase a right to oversee how many neighbors you'll have or how they choose to live their lives. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us, 919-832-5138. Once again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long till next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.